Dave Fanning on 2FM.
2FM. Now, it's hard these days to know what's true and what's not. We live in a world of misinformation, fake news, propaganda, etc. Lies can spread at an alarming pace thanks to social media and the internet, and such lies are taken as fact. Similarly, we no longer trust experts in the way that we once did. So for that reason, the book I have in my hand is an important one. It's a call for us to return to evidence-based reasoning. The book is called The Irrational Ape, or to give it the full title, The Irrational Ape: Why Flawed Logic Puts Us All at Risk and How Critical Thinking Can Save the World. It's by David Robert Grimes, who's with me now. So, David, you're very welcome to the programme. I'm going to give you a quote, just throw this one back at you. We're the first generation in human history for whom information on any and all subjects is available at our fingertips. And there's a massive danger in that. Discuss that one, David.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the paradox of a time in which we live is that we can go online and get essentially the entire repository of human knowledge right there. But the downside of that is that all manner of misinformation and often disinformation perpetuates with even more veracity. So sifting out the signal from the noise has never been more difficult. So there's a bit of an irony in that as well.
So I'm going to jump to the very end of the book where you talk about healthy skepticism. It should be our default position, shouldn't it?
Well, I would certainly agree, and I hope that I argue that quite strongly, but it's not intuitive. Like, we all think that we're, and to an extent,
we have to work at it, is that what you mean?
Well, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we do have a tendency to only adopt information that suits our prejudices a little bit. We see it in politics.
That defines the world of today.
Isn't that part of a tragedy? It doesn't have to be that way. I mean, I mean, it's very easy to be cynical, but I am optimistic that we all have this incredible ability to make more sense of situations than we're currently making. And I think skepticism, in the scientific sense of the word, is an essential tool in getting there.
Well, the Carl Sagan thing of extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, etc. But so many, require you, if you like, to prove that they're wrong, and not that they should verify. I mean, you should always demand evidence. There's too much work being done by people in the know just trying to kind of back away the other stuff.
Well, that's it. I mean, there's what's classically called the law of bullshit asymmetry, where it takes an order of magnitude more energy to refute a false claim than it takes to make it in the first instance.
Yeah.
And it's a massive drain on resources for sure. But the real imperative for all of us is to realize that the onus is always on the person making a claim to substantiate it, not on us to disprove what they have said. If someone gives us information, we really need to go, well, why do you think that? And from whence did you derive that knowledge? And when you start asking a simple set of questions, which I think in the book we go through quite a bit, you can very quickly save yourself a lot of energy and realize, well, is this something I should take more seriously? Should I reevaluate my own position? That is important, by the way. We really have to be willing to also realize that our positions are often mistaken and should be updated. And there's no shame in that. There is only shame in refusing to correct our positions when the evidence is overwhelmingly against us.
Okay, so healthy skepticism and always demand evidence. But we do have to rely on impartial experts and expert bodies, etc. Can we trust them?
On average, yes. And that's a really important thing. So if you take a doctor or a scientist, for example, if a doctor is speaking to you and they're reflecting the opinion of a WHO and all these big, massive bodies, it's overwhelmingly likely that you can take that as the truth. However, you can still get fringe elements both in the scientific and medical community that will make all sorts of claims. The classic example you might think of is someone like Andrew Wakefield, who was a physician who started up the MMR vaccine autism link, which is non-existent. But that person, with their authority as a doctor, was able to bamboozle people. However, he was a minority making this claim, whereabouts the vast majority of medical bodies were saying the exact opposite thing. So you also have to put it in context and go, is this person making a claim that is the consensus claim, or are they giving me a minority report and trying to present it by virtue of their authority? And if they are speaking without the authority of the evidence behind them, the only authority a physician or an expert or a scientist derives is when they are reflecting the evidence. If they go off-piste, they are no longer speaking as an expert.
And the whole Trump and Brexit thing as well, the whole kind of science and climate change and the healthcare and the vaccines, etc. There's been an awful lot of stuff that even we don't know what it is we're supposed to be knowing in some ways. I mean, it's just like, I'll give you an example just to go back to towards the end of the book, by the way, your healthy skepticism, where you talk about a woman who kidnapped her own child just so that the doctors couldn't do to the child what they wanted to do, which was obviously the right thing to do, because she thought she had a better idea about what to do from reading so much stuff on the internet, that there are loads of cures out there that we haven't been told about, kind of thing. Now, you do say at one stage here that the concepts articulated by Miss Roberts are not unique. The belief that there are cures for cancer suppressed by medical science and the pharmaceutical industry is an enduring one. And you talk about the billion-dollar industry, the multi-billion-dollar industry. Is there any truth at all in the fact that, well, I don't trust the medical establishment, I'm going to find stuff on the internet and maybe I'll find something better?
I can understand why people do it. So yeah, that was a Neon Roberts case when a seven-year-old child was abducted by his own mother. Now, he needed radiotherapy for a brain tumour. It was survivable, but he needed that treatment. She went online, Googled a rake of alternative healers who made all sorts of insubstantiated claims, and it started a manhunt, and eventually the courts ordered he needed his treatment. He's now doing fine, yeah, incidentally.
Because he got the treatment.
They
found the child and the mother
but
4 days
the
later.
The reason that she was... had been so misled is because there are a whole host of charlatans and frauds and misguided people who really believe that they can do this. Now, the fact that they believe it is irrelevant, they can't. They can't produce the evidence to substantiate those kind of claims. She was not able to parse that. She had her own reasons as well, as you've read and you've gone into a bit of detail on it. But is there any truth to it? Are the pharmaceutical industry, say, covering up cancer cures? Well, we can ask that as a simple question. We can break it down. Firstly, cancer isn't just one disease. It's a whole family of over 200 known maladies, all of which are very, very different and respond different to treatment and therapy. So we use cancer as a catch-all,
but it's
not really one disease.
Right.
More than that, the other factor as well is, if there was a cure for cancer, even if it was from something entirely natural that you could just synthesize and make up, it would be incredibly profitable. Over half of us in our lifetime will get cancer.
Yeah.
Even if you were selling it for peanuts, if you're selling that to half the world for peanuts, you're still making a lot of money.
Will it be as profitable as the exploratory industry for the cure is there at the moment? Millions of people in work trying to find a cure. Like, okay.
Oh, it's a but that just shows you how complicated the problem is. I mean, I work in cancer research and I came from a physics background going into cancer, and you get an immediate appreciation of the reason we've made massive strides, by the way. Cancer survival has never been better. There are some forms of cancer
Absolutely. That
are curable.
Are all experts disposed to act in the interests of others?
I don't think so at all. Mm. Actually, one of the things I say in the book is expert is a really nebulous term. Because what do we mean by expert? Well, depending on the field, expertise in one domain doesn't necessarily transfer into expertise in another. And that's a mistake we often
make. And it doesn't stop
a
lot of these experts pretending that it does.
Absolutely. I mean, there's an old joke about you see someone who gets a Nobel Prize and they retire and they become an absolute crank. I talk a few about it in the book. You had Linus Pauling, for example, the only man in history to win two Nobel Prizes on his own, separately, became this zealot for vitamin C cures cancer, cures the common cold. And because of his reputation, people thought he was an expert. This is the reason to this day, when you get a cold, someone comes up to you and goes, oh, maybe you should take more vitamin C. Vitamin C doesn't work for the common cold. But yet Linus Pauling's reputation as an expert, as a great man of science, was allowed him to sell that myth to people.
What about the aspect of that, the placebo, whatever? There is the effect, isn't there?
Well, there's two things to take apart with placebo stuff. You got the placebo effect, which is the fact that if we think something is working for us, particularly on subjective symptoms, it makes us feel better. The other thing going on there is a statistical thing called regression to the mean. And what's happening there is you go to seek relief for your symptoms when they're at their absolute zenith, when they're at their worst, right? And that stage, you start taking something, but your body's already been working on that for a while. So suddenly you attribute the healing factor.
Exactly.
Yeah, you regress back to what's normal and you go, obviously that magical potion I took worked. Where in fact your body, you should give your body more credit. It was probably doing most of the hard work the whole time. The evil twin of the placebo effect is the nocebo effect from the Latin, I will harm. And if you convince something that something is doing them harm, it's very hard. That's why you often get people fainting, for example, when they get vaccination. If they're expecting to faint, they often will, because the psychological aspect is absolutely huge. But the other thing is, that's the post-procurator hoc. I'm getting the Latin a bit wrong there. But just because one thing follows something doesn't mean it caused it. But when you saw, for example, the MMR autism scare back in the early 2000s, which I'm sure you remember well, the big thing was you had children being diagnosed as autistic around the time they got their vaccinations, and people made that connection. The connection was misleading, because actually you get your vaccinations around the time you become verbal, and around the time you should become verbal is when usually autism, the signs of it manifest. So that coincidence was enough for people to think it was causative when it
and
was
the
not.
Widening diagnostic criteria, if you like, for autism
Absolutely.
Was happening kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, suddenly kids that at once had been institutionalised and hid away from society, well, we were realising this was a spectrum and they were being integrated more. So it was more visual. And conversely, the things that the MMR vaccine protected against, measles, which killed... still kills over like a million. The measles vaccine saves over a million lives a year.
Yeah.
This was a devastating illness that we had no cultural consciousness of anymore because the vaccine had been so successful.
Yeah, exactly.
All we had was what's called the availability heuristic. What was to our hand? We could see autistic kids. We couldn't see kids dying of measles anymore. Unfortunately, that is now making something of a resurgence.
Okay, by the way, we are talking to David Robert Grimes, fascinating book called The Irrational Ape. The Irrational Ape, there's me doing it. Why Flawed Logic Puts Us All at Risk and How Critical Thinking Can Save the World. Do you think that our ability to think critically has never been more important because of fake news and expert mistrust and all the rest of it? Or do you not think that in some ways that since there was no rolling 24-hour news, there was no internet, there was no anything years ago, the people just had to believe what their leaders told them and they went with it and they weren't even in a position to have critical thinking?
I don't think any technology is intrinsically bad. For example, it's very easy for people to go, oh, the internet or social media are just bad. But that's essentialism. It doesn't really make sense. What has become a bit more difficult is parsing between what is reputable and reprehensible. That has certainly become far more difficult. And the thing is, this has always been a problem. As you point out, we've been misled since time immemorial. But the problem is we have access to information, but that's also been weaponized against us.
Yeah.
The reason critical thinking is more important now than ever is that the sheer volume of what we can do, we can either get it really, really right or extremely wrong. And it's never been more urgent that we learn to differentiate between the two to make better decisions. Like the challenges we face as a species are astronomical. We're facing climate change, a resurgence of Cold War geopolitics and disinformation on a huge scale. It's now falls to each one of us to be able to make not just our own lives better, but the world.
OK, to be able to make not just our own lives better, but the world as well. I mean, misinformation and falsehoods, they spread faster than ever, further the era where, as we said, knowledge is at your fingertips, etc. We're all kind of lured into making critical mistakes, drawing false conclusions, etc. So how can we actually do the next step? How can we avoid making the mistake of drawing false conclusions?
I think that there's two steps to this process. And the first step is to be aware of where we go wrong. So some of the mistakes we make are logical. Sometimes we're easily swayed by rhetorical or demagoguery, things like that. We have psychological biases, which are huge, and I focus a lot on them in the book, that we have our own blind spots. We often, as Paul Simon says, it's all lies and jest, still the man hears what he wants to hear
and disregards the rest.
But we do that, and we do that now on the internet on an epic scale. The traditional gatekeepers of media have always been the traditional media outlets. Their influence has reduced now that we are our own curators. So it's more important than ever. We're also misled by, indeed, the media we consume, as in we now are our own curators of that media. So knowing those problems and those pitfalls is really important. The next part of the process is, you know, being aware of it's half the battle. The next half of it is going, OK, so what are the questions I should ask? What are the positions I should take when I'm faced with new information? How do I gauge the veracity of this? And more often, and this is really important, to recognize that we're not always right ourselves. It's not just a case of us being right and trying to be more right. Sometimes you will get information that makes you realize, oh, good Lord, I've been wrong about this for a long time. And realizing there's no shame in that. That is a virtue, not a fault.
Okay, well, Greta Thunberg will just try to say, like, just don't listen to me at all, except for one sentence. Listen to the experts. Listen to the scientists. If you do that, then that's fine. I'll be the conduit if I happen to be, because I'm the one being interviewed here. But please listen to the scientists, and I'm the famous one, or whatever it happens to be, even by default. So why are so many people tempted by climate change denial or by medicines that clearly don't work, etc.? Why is it that we are? Is it simply that we want to be?
Well, that's a really interesting question. And one of the big things with climate change denial is it's really strongly correlated with your support for the free market and how conservative you are as personality traits. And that seems a bit weird, but if you think about it, it makes perfect sense. If you believe in the free market like a hardcore libertarian might, right? And you're told climate change is a reality and you might have to change your behavior and you're impinging on your neighbor in a way that you didn't think you were.
Yeah.
You have two options then. This is where you get a thing called cognitive dissonance. You can either sit and go, God, yeah, I have to refine the limits of my philosophy a little bit. that's very uncomfortable for a lot of people and they're not willing to do it. And it's cognitively expensive. What is much easier to do is to deny and reduce.
Yeah.
So you, when you're faced with these options, you can either change your position in light of the evidence or you can dismiss the evidence. And far too many people with climate change denial dismiss the evidence. You see similar in alternative medicine as well, that people really want to believe that natural things are good, which doesn't really make sense because natural is evanescent. We can't really define it. You know, arsenic and uranium are natural, but I wouldn't put them on my breakfast cereal, for example. And then when they're confronted with evidence of harm from their wares, they can either go, well, yeah, maybe I should change my mind, which is hard to do and noble, but hard to do. Or they can dismiss it and say it's a big conspiracy. And you get into these circles. We run around in circles an awful lot.
So therefore, like all this business of everything natural is good, everything natural is safe. No, hold on a second. Don't be so stupid. It's not, for starters. And also, the whole snake oil salesman kind of approach to life, like psychics here and, you know, jade eggs there, all the rest of it, etc. I mean, I presume a lot of them are harmless and some of them are simply not harmless. Well, like, I know people who genuinely, well, I don't know necessarily, but I do, that like, you know, that, you know, like you have pages and pages and pages in a lot of popular newspapers of psychics and... what do you call it? The Sagittarius and Pisces and all the rest
absolutely.
Of it. All that stuff. And believing every single word of it.
And the funny thing is, there's a classic psychology experiment I always love, which is a guy called Fourier came in and gave his students a personality test that he'd written for them. And this is in the 1940s. And he asked them to assess how accurate it was and individually. And they all gave it like a massive accuracy rating. And then he eventually asked them to swap it with their colleagues. And he'd given everyone in the class the same assessment. He had taken it from horoscopes. He'd taken all the statements out of them, put them together in a big mishmash. He found that horoscopes, for example, tend to be quite flattering. And we are more inclined to believe flattering information about ourselves than something that's challenging. But they're also generic enough to apply to everyone. So if people grasp truth in them, well, they're grasping truth for sure because they're generic Barnum statements. They make perfect sense. The question they're not asking is, how do I test this statement?
Yeah.
Is this a statement I should accept on faith? Or should I go, what would be the opposite? And because we don't take that necessary next step, I can totally see why astrology appeals to people and that they find a version of meaning in it, but it is essentially white noise.
I know, but like, isn't it the same as what people would say about Fox News? It's the same as, like, if, I don't know if you've watched the best TV program of the last 10 years called Succession, but it's the same thing in that too, that people are selling in big time money, like trillions of dollars, people news that they want rather than news that they need to have.
And that's part of, this is part, it's very easy to disparage media outlets, right? And Fox News, I totally encourage people disparaging Fox News, I should say. But I think that it's very hard for traditional media outlets at the moment because we have this thing about polarization. We have a thing about appealing to your audience so much. We value velocity over veracity. And instead of rewarding, say, inventive investigative reporting, because it's like we're looking for a cheap fix all the time, it's putting media outlets on the back foot. But they have an essential role in actually being gatekeepers against misinformation.
Yeah, and what you hear might be uncomfortable, but that's what you need to hear sometimes, yeah. By the way, we are talking, just one or two last bits, to David Robert Grimes' fascinating book called The Irrational Ape, Why Flawed Logic Puts Us All at Risk and How Critical Thinking Can Save the World. Just this business of getting back to placebos and all the rest of it. I mean, you know, we do know how we feel sometimes and how it is best for us to do whatever. Like, I'm a kind of a person who doesn't take pills really for anything at all, much at all, and that's just the way it is. And look how fabulously healthy I am. But no, the point is that, like, you know, you are the best judge about what's right for your body. No, you're not.
Well, no one is unless they happen to be an internal medicine specialist or something. I mean,
get with the program here, folks. Like, there are experts here doing things that are really good. And as you say, look what's happened to cancer in the last 20 years. Yeah. I mean, like, the amounts of cancers that are just being banished or whatever, or to open heart surgery and all this kind of thing.
But you know what surprises people, for example? With cancer, you can take two bits of information in isolation and confuse yourself. Survival rates for cancer have never been better. We have never made more inroads than ever before. However, you can look in isolation at the fact that cancer rates are increasing. For example, a century ago, about a third of people got cancer, and now it's about half. And people get very panicked when they hear that. They think the world's become more carcinogenic.
And there are reasons.
Yeah. The simple reason is this. Cancer is primarily a disease of aging. We're living longer because we're no longer succumbing to cholera and tuberculosis and all the stuff that killed our forebears. But that information in isolation, it lends itself to quackery as well, because then people can then say it's 5G making you sick, or it's fluoride in the water, or it's vaccinations. The reality is we're living longer. It's a sign of the success of cancer treatment and on other medical treatments that we're living that much longer that we can get cancer, because eventually you roll the genetic dice long enough, you get cancer.
Just going back to something completely kind of different or off the subject in some ways, but the idea of secularism in the Irish education system, from your point of view, I mean, like, wouldn't it be better if we were taught something that was kind of real?
Well, I've certainly argued this in print before, and I've made some enemies in doing so. I think absolutely. I think religious instruction, personally, I'm fine if you're for it, but it probably should be happening outside of a classroom situation. I would never want to take anyone's right to have religious expression away from them. And I certainly would think secular education is the way to go, with religious instruction outside the classroom.
And finally, just kind of on one or two of those bits, do ideological beliefs get in the way of the facts of what is true, which is really, they do, don't they? That's
absolutely,
that's the problem.
Yeah, when I started writing this book, I was like, okay, this will be, you know, almost like, and I was immediately struck by how important the psychology of how we believe and why we believe is overbearing. It stretches into every facet of
And as
this.
You say, you've got into trouble for a lot of things, because standing up for science in the face of adversity, you do this. In fact, you've won a prize, the John Maddox Prize for standing up for science.
Absolutely. I mean, the Maddox Prize was a nice award. Unfortunately, I got that because I get the most hate mail of most science writers that year, so I got it. But I think it is very important to say, look, it's very easy for the public to be misled, and I think as scientists and we have a responsibility to go and say, well, I'd like to live in a world where we're making decisions based on evidence, the best available evidence, and not being misled by charlatans and demagogues and fools. And originally that was just for science, but the more I look at it, this applies to our political lives as well. We look across the Atlantic at Brexit happening and the absolute nonsense that is coming out of the mouth of Boris Johnson, or go to the other side, to the other blonde twit over in America, and you look at these two things and go, these situations should never have ever transpired in the first instance, if only people had been a little bit better at going, hang on, can we take these claims at face value? What should we be doing? What are we looking forward to? Instead, we were very easily manipulated by rhetoric and demagoguery.
Yeah.
And the only shield against these tin pot dictators is critical thinking. It is the only thing that you can put there and say, how do I protect myself from people who would lie to me? Well, I learn how to question.
Right, indeed. Well, listen, there's so much more, and it's fascinating stuff. The Irrational Ape, Why Flawed Logic Puts Us All at Risk and How Critical Thinking Can Save the World. It's by David Robert Grimes, out now. What's the publisher there? How does
he make sure? Simon & Schuster.
Very good.
David, I hope I got that right.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for dropping into us on the programme this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Dave Fanning on 2FM. 2FM.